Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Continuing the readings from the Ajahn Sumedho anthology, volume 3, called Direct Realization. And these are talks from the book called The Way It Is. And these are mostly Dhamma talks that Lumpur Sumedho gave in 1988 during the winter retreat here at Amaravati. This is chapter 13, The Sound of Silence. When you grow calm, you can experience the sound of silence in the mind. You hear it as a kind of high-frequency sound, a ringing sound that's always there, but is normally never noticed. When you now begin to hear that sound of silence, it's a sign of emptiness, of the silence of the mind. It's something you can always turn to. As you concentrate on it and turn to it, it can make you quite peaceful, blissful. Meditating on that, you have a way of letting the conditions of the mind cease without suppressing them with another condition. Otherwise, you just end up putting one condition over another. Just to begin by acknowledging that this inner sound, also called the nada in Sanskrit, which just means the sound. Some people hear this quite easily, some people don't hear it at all, some people hear it very, very loudly, and it's very dominating. Sometimes people experience this, say, inner vibration rather than as a sound, as a felt sense, like a sort of tingling in the fingertips, or sometimes as an aspect of the visual field, a kind of shimmering of the world of sight, the visual consciousness. So it can vary from person to person. And so whenever I'm giving instruction about this, even though I found this very easy to access myself and I've used it a lot as a meditation object, I can hear it right now as I'm speaking to all of you. It's always been quite accessible to me that the fact is that's not the case. That's not the same for everybody. And so some people find this as an inaccessible meditation object, or this whole area of practice is something that doesn't bear much relevance because of their own disposition, their own experience. So when I'm giving instruction about this, I usually add on the sort of the rider that, well, if this is not something that you can hear or you can feel or doesn't make any sense to you, then please just use something else, like the rhythm of the breath or a different meditation object. But for myself, I found it's extremely beneficial. It's very helpful as a meditation object. And a few readings ago, I was saying how one of the particular aspects of it that I find helpful is that it doesn't respond to personal will. You can't decide to make it do anything. You can't make it go louder or quieter or anything of that nature. You can either pay attention to it or not pay attention to it. But it doesn't respond to personal will. So it's something that can, in a way, support the seeing of things in terms of nature and to de-emphasize the role of the sense of self, of I, me doing a practice, or me in charge of something, me the owner of something. So rather like we feel the pull of gravity, we feel the weight of the body, we feel the pull of gravity, say drawing our body to the surface of the planet. We don't think of my gravity. I don't think in any of our languages Most people here don't have English as their first language, but nobody talks about my gravity. It's like you don't say I beat my heart, and so that The feeling of weight, the pull of the force of gravity, is something that we all experience. If we turn our attention to it, we say, "Oh yeah, right. I can feel the weight of my body. I feel the presence of that." But it's not something personal. It's felt here. It's known within the sphere of this awareness. But it's not something that the mind takes personal ownership of. I would say for most people. So that the using the inner sound, the sound of silence, as a meditation object can in a similar way be a focus for attention, but something that is non-personal and is seen as a natural quality of the field of experience. Lumpur's comment here, as you concentrate on it and turn to it, it can make you quite peaceful, blissful. Meditating on that, you have a way of letting go of the conditions of the mind, letting the conditions of the mind cease without suppressing them with another condition. So I would say that that's true, but also the inner sound is also a condition. it's an auditory effect. It's part of the ear consciousness, I would say. And so it is a condition, but I would say it's a subtle perception that helps the mind to keep a perspective on the more coarse perceptions, the more, say, powerful conditions of mind, like feeling sad or angry or lonely or lustful or fearful and such like, or having a loud sound that we're hearing around us, or some bright colors, or a distinctive smell, and so on. I would say the inner sound, it is a condition, it's a perception, it's within the sanya kanda, the field of perception, the group of experiences labeled perception, but it's a subtle condition, and its great value is that it can help the other conditions of mind, perceptions, thoughts, emotions and so on, be known and seen more distinctly. That's how I would relate to it. And as Lumpur goes on to say, you have a way of letting the conditions of the mind cease without suppressing them with another condition. Otherwise, you just end up putting one condition over another. This process is what is meant by making kamma, quote unquote. For example, if you're feeling angry and you start thinking of something else to get away from the anger, this is just putting one condition on top of another. You don't like what's going on over here, so you look over there. You just run away. But if you have a way of turning from conditioned phenomena to the unconditioned, no kind of kamma is being made, and the conditioned habits can fade away and cease. It's like a safety hatch in the mind, the way out. So your karmic formations, sankhara, have an exit, a way of flowing away instead of recreating themselves. So I would say that the inner sound, listening to the sound of silence, it's a way of, say, keying the attention into the quality of the unconditioned. It's a condition, I would say, it's a perception, it's not the unconditioned itself, but by focusing upon that quality and some of the attributes that it has, help the mind to awaken to that timeless, unborn, unconditioned quality of Dhamma itself. So I would say it's a symbol of Dhamma, it's a symbol of the unconditioned, but it's in itself, it is conditioned, it's a perception, it's a kind of a form in the hearing consciousness. I think it's good to understand it, or to relate to it in that way. Sometimes you come across different spiritual teachings that speak about this. You find it in the Vedic tradition, in Hinduism. You find it also in the Sikh tradition. It's called the Yoga of Inner Light and Sound, as I understand it, in the Sikh tradition. And you have it represented in different ways and forms, and some of them sometimes talk about it in terms of if you can hear this sound, it means you are enlightened, or you're a It's a kind of spiritual purity in and of itself, and some people even promote a very expensive meditation workshops that introduce you, give you the secret initiation into hearing the sound, and then you're $3,000 poorer after the weekend, but they're sort of revealed as some kind of sacred initiation. But I would say that's over, overdoing it a bit. I would say it's a skillful means that we can use. It's not anything that we don't have that has to be given to you by a guru or a teacher, or that you have to really be initiated into in some kind of special way, but rather it's a natural function of the living system, of the mind-body system, and it can be attended to. It can be used as a skillful means for bringing attention to the present. And then the fact that it's a sensory object, but that it has attributes that, say, are good symbols for the Dhamma, or that have qualities that resonate, or are indicative of qualities of the Dhamma itself, I feel is quite helpful. The fact that, like I was saying, it's not under personal control, that's one good thing. It never seems to begin and end. You can't sort of hear it start or hear it stop, at least I never have. You know? It's always the sense of ever present, that it doesn't have a beginning or an ending, so that helps to, support the timeless quality, or the akaliko quality of the Dhamma, and that it's a non-personal feature of our field of experience. It doesn't come across as male or female or old or young or have a nationality, like gravity. You know, you don't have French gravity or British gravity or Hungarian gravity or Irish gravity. It's like, no, it's just, we might have those nationalities as human conventions, but the felt presence of that quality is the same, irrespective of where these bodies happen to have been born, and have resided. So it's got a kind of unifying natural quality to it in that way. So that I feel that's it's a sense object. And it's conditioned and formed, but it's a good symbol for the unconditioned, for the timeless and non-personal, immanent quality of Dhamma itself. So any questions, comments, thoughts before I continue? This is quite a short Dhamma talk. So. Yes, Roman, if you can come and get the microphone.
Ajahn, a couple of days ago, Emily brought up the question of the breath, that it's kind of automatic, but you can also control it with your will. And that made me think of, actually, that's a good meditation object to explore volition, or the effect of volition, because you get an immediate feedback on when you drop volition, that it's the more you let go, the more you recede, the deeper you can go. And so now when you talked about the sound as the meditation object, as being constant and completely independent of will, it makes me think of, it's more like, that would, in that line of thinking, encourage more of a passivity as opposed to the breath.
It's an interesting question. To be honest, I hadn't thought of it in that way, so thank you for that. So another perspective on it. One of the interesting things that I find is that the more you concentrate on the inner sound, the brighter the mind becomes. So in terms of passivity, it actually becomes, in a way, harder to be passive, because there's a positive feedback loop. The more you concentrate on it, the brighter the mind becomes, the more energized the mind becomes. So the more you concentrate on it, the easier it is to concentrate. So you don't tend to drift into passive attitudes, by my experience, because the sheer level of alertness, arousal of the mind is being supported by the act of concentration. Whereas often with the breath, it tends towards the mind going more dull and sleepy or tranquil. It doesn't naturally energize raise the quality of virya and energy within the system. I think the other thing to say on it would be individual experience is quite different. It's going to have different effects on different people. So that if one finds that by using the inner sound, the nada as a meditation object, that conduces to mind being more passive and less using the quality of investigation, and it's good to notice that and to be aware of that and realize, oh no, I need to emphasize that quality of investigation and to stress that, because the mind is tending to just go into a sort of benign, sort of pleasant sunbathing state, as it were, just kind of switching off and kind of just enjoying the quietness without any real wisdom faculty being raised there. One of the other aspects of the inner sound as a meditation object that I emphasize is that you can use it just for concentration. It can be developed in that way so that you are deliberately focusing on that to exclude other patterns of experience, and so it can be used very directly to support samatha concentration and one-pointedness, and if that's done, then that does tend to make the sound louder, or you can hear more layers, more different more and different frequencies within the sound, and also makes it the mind brighter or more energized. Particularly if it's used for a concentration object. But you can, instead of using it for concentration, you can use it as a support for insight, so that you deliberately allow the sound to be sort of there in the background. Like right now, I can hear it as I'm talking to you, and so that you can use the inner sound as a support for vipassana practice, so it's sort of there in the background as you let the attention be more open, so open to the whole field of experience, so that you're not just trying to focus on a single object, just like the sound, but you're opening up to different thoughts or emotions or other perceptions that are coming and going and changing. And particularly, this is very good for walking meditation, if you, because your visual field is changing, your body is moving, different sensations that are there. But you can hold the inner sound there as a kind of backdrop to experience, and then that helps to keep it clear that this is a field of changing perceptions and thoughts and different sankharas arising and passing away, so that the inner sound is not quite so energizing or not quite so so loud in that respect, in my experience anyway. But it's there as a screen against which the array of different experiences are projected. So it's much easier to recognize, oh, this is just thinking, this is just an emotion, this is a memory, this is a physical sensation, or this is the image of a tree, here is the watching of the buzzard circling overhead, or here is the feeling of coldness, or the feeling of excitement at seeing a daisy in the grass, or whatever. So that then the inner sound is helping the mind to keep track, or this is just a flow of perceptions that the mind forms into the world, and this is what's happening. So that if the mind is tending towards more passivity by using that, then you can, rather than having it as a concentration object, you can use it more as a background. And so rather than what Lumpur Sumedha would call, rather than using it as the point which excludes, like you're focusing just on that one point and shutting everything else out, it's there to support what he calls the point which includes. So, you know, the whole field of experience of the present moment is the meditation object. So that then the inner sound, it's being used, it's a helpful presence, But it's rather helping to support the process of insight, the development of insight and wise reflection, rather than concentration. And then it definitely doesn't lead to passivity in that respect, in my experience anyway. It's also, it's interesting, Lumpur made the comment, it's a sign of emptiness. The Spanish word nada means nothing. So it's an interesting coincidence. In Sanskrit, it means sound. In Spanish, if I can correct the Spanish speaker here, nada means nothing. And so that it's it's definitely a sign of emptiness, especially if you're a Spanish speaker. So you're listening to the sound of nothing or the sound of no thing. Can you use the microphone? Yeah. So everyone can hear.
Nada means to swim as well.
To swim?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
He's swimming, something like that.
Swimming in nothingness.
Yeah.
I never knew that. That's another interesting piece to add to it. If you can ask through the microphone. Thank you.
So can I ask, because is it really a sound, or because they say, or as I read, like in very deep like absorption or very deep concentration, the like sound, the ear consciousness, like it can be like cease, it can cease, so you cannot hear. So is it similarly not really a sound, or is it like completely vanishing on hearing all sounds, even like the sound of silence? If you're experiencing in your meditation, is it like when you really like get deep concentration with this sound?
For myself, I'm not that expert of a meditator in terms of deep states of concentration. You have to find somebody who's skilled with arupa jhana and say, "Can you hear that sound?" If you're in formless jhana, but certainly. When any kind of state of meditation that I've developed, that sound is always there in the background. If I turn the attention to it, you don't have to listen to it, but if you turn the attention to it, then I've noticed it's always there. Other questions, thoughts? Okay, so to continue. One problem with meditation is that many people find it boring. People become bored with emptiness. They want to fill up emptiness with something. So, recognize that even when the mind is quite empty, the desires and habits are still there, and they will come and want to do something interesting. You have to be patient, willing to turn away from boredom and from the desire to do something interesting, and be content with the emptiness of the sound of silence. And you have to be quite determined in turning towards it. But when you begin to listen and understand the mind better, the emptiness of the sound of silence is a very realizable possibility for all of us. After many years of practice, gross karmic formations fade away, and the more subtle ones also start to fade. The mind becomes increasingly emptier and clearer, but it takes a lot of patience, endurance, and willingness to keep practicing under all conditions and to let go even of one's most treasured little habits. One of the things with respect to boredom is that I would suggest it depends upon a sense of self, that the more that I am there, then the more easily the mind gets bored. If the mind has let go of self-view and conceit, then it's impossible to be bored. The present moment, whatever it contains in terms of sense objects and experiences, it's never boring if the mind is free of self. And you can experiment with that. please prove me wrong if you like. But in terms of exploring that and experimenting with the mind, that seems to be a close relationship. That as long as I am there, then boredom is possible. But if the I has been let go of, if there's no sense of I and me and mine, then the present is delightful, is interesting. Even if there's a painful feeling, the mind is not bored with it. So self and time are closely related. So it's also when the mind lets go of self, then it's also not creating a past and a future. I mean, you can have memories or ideas, but it's not getting into that mode of waiting for things to change so that it will be more comfortable or be better or be more interesting, that you're not bored with this because something more pleasing or promising is going to happen in a little while. So that letting go of self-view and conceit is also a way of letting go of time and restlessness, and so that there's an inner satisfaction that the heart has. The jitta naturally feels satisfied and comfortable with the present, regardless of the sense objects that might be there. And the more attuned it is to Dhamma, the more awake it is to the Pachupana Dhamma, the here and now Dhamma, and the less there is any kind of conceit, self-view, then the felt sense of the present is easeful and joyful, peaceful, and there's no sense of wanting this to change so something more interesting will happen in the future, or recollecting something that was more pleasing or more completing and more interesting in the past. Another of the aspects of this meditation on the sound of silence was that this is something that Lumpo Sumato developed independently. He didn't know it was a kind of spiritual tradition, but it was rather because he started hearing it very, very loudly. It was when he was here in England in the late 70s, he was living in London at the Hampstead Vihara. But in those days, I think London's a bit different now, but in those days, I lived in London at the same time, not far away from Hampstead. And the city basically stopped at about 11 or 11:30 at night. There were no more buses, no more tube trains, all the pubs were closed. And so London at midnight was mostly extremely quiet. And so it was, I think, particularly in the winter time that Lumpo started to notice that when he was sitting meditating in the Vihara, that he would hear this inner sound going very, very loudly in the background. And then the more he focused on it, the easier it was to notice it. And then even when he was on his arms round, walking through the streets of Hampstead and on Hampstead Heath, he heard it really, really clearly and loudly. And so being a very experimental, having an inquisitive nature, he thought, well, rather than this just being some sort of sensory oddity, maybe you can put this to work. Maybe you can use this as a meditation object. So that he began to deliberately turn his attention to it and to experiment with using it. And so a lot of his insight and his experience with the inner sound was just on his own initiative. And then it was a few years later, I think when he was teaching at, once Chithurst Monastery had opened, and he was teaching, and I think it was at a Buddhist Society summer school event, and he mentioned this as a practice that he'd been doing, and somebody said, "Well, you know, of course, this is an ancient Hindu practice as well." And he said, "Oh, is it really?" I said, "Oh, yes. I mean, you must have known about it," and then proceeded to give him information about that as a practice within the Hindu tradition. And and then also within the Sikh tradition, as I said, it's known as the yoga of inner light and sound. So as he started to look into it, he found that there was various different spiritual traditions had developed it as a skillful means. Also in the Greek tradition, the Greek philosophers seem to have referred to it as the music of the spheres. In the Vedic tradition, in the Vedas and Upanishads, it's also called the Brahmanada, the divine sound. And then he also came across a teacher, a man called Salim Mikhail, who was living in France, who had written about this as a meditation method. There's a book called, it was originally called The Way of Inner Vigilance, and I think it's got to been republished with a different title now. But so somebody said, "Yeah, you know, Ajahn Sumedho, you've been talking about this inner listening, this sound. Here's a whole book about it." And he said, "Oh my goodness, the Way of Inner Vigilance is thank you." And so then I think he actually got in touch with Salim Mikhail and met him. Yes. So it developed into a bit of a relationship. And I think he, when they republished it, or maybe when Salim Mikhail wrote another book, then Ajahn Sumedho wrote an introduction or a foreword for it, so that it turned into a fruitful collaboration. Another interesting little story with respect to that was when I was with Lumpur in California before Abhayagiri Monastery had opened up. He was invited to lead a meditation retreat for a couple of weeks at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, which is a large monastery in the northern tradition established by Master Xuan Hua. And so he was teaching this method of listening to the inner sound to the community, to the group of people gathered there. So many of them were Lumpur Sumedho's regular students out of the southern Buddhist world, American meditators, and but quite a number of the monastic community from the City of 10,000 Buddhas, both the Western monks and nuns and Chinese monks and nuns were gathered together. And when he started talking about using the inner sound as a meditation object, then one of the American monks said, Ajahn Sumedho, I think that you've finally helped us solve the mystery of what's called the Shurangama Samadhi. And he said, the what? And this monk was explaining, there's this very important meditation sutra, the Shurangama Sutra, which is, I think it's only found in the Chinese tradition. And it was the main meditation teaching that was used by Master Xu Yun, who was the teacher of Master Hua, and also the monk whose teachings that Lumpur Sumedho had used when he was a layman in the Peace Corps in Borneo, that a number of Dhamma talks from Master Xu Yun had been translated into English, and that Lumpur had used the meditation method there. So anyway, the Shurangama Sutra was the main meditation text for Master Xu Yun. And so Master Hua had the community studying it and had done his own commentary on it. And there was this one particular passage that they had been really puzzling over when they were trying to put it into English. And I haven't looked at it recently, but it says something like, you return the hearing to listen to the self nature, and the self nature realizes the true way. And then they were asking Master Hua, so what does this mean, this returning the hearing to listen to the self nature? And then Master Hua said, well, it's also, you can say, returning the hearing to listen to the ear organ. He says, the ear organ, it's not the ear, it's the ear organ. And they go, what's he talking about? And he said, we've been going back and forth for years trying to figure this out and talking to the master and getting his feedback, and he's tried to explain it, and we've never been able to try it, never been able to really understand what it means. But I think, you've finally cracked the puzzle. And so that was a very interesting dialogue opened up with respect to that. And it's particularly significant because in that sutra, what you have is a number of the bodhisattvas come to the Buddha, and they describe the different meditation methods that each of them has used to realize enlightenment. And the last one on the list, again, if I remember correctly, is Guanyin Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara. And when Avalokiteshvara describes the meditation that they've used, that's where the description of returning the hearing to listen to the self nature, or to listen to the ear organ, and then the Buddha says, and this is the most excellent. This is the best method for realizing enlightenment, and so but it was mysterious or puzzling to them that this is, say, laid out as being the most excellent and liberating or most effective meditation method, but they couldn't quite understand what the method was. So it was intriguing and puzzling, and really wanted to figure it out. And then during the course of this retreat, then that the listening to the inner sound, it's not that say that they ascribed Lumpur Samhita to completely to solving the puzzle or having all of the answers, but rather this sounds like it could be exactly what the meditation teaching is referring to. So this is definitely worth following up. So it was a connection there with the Chinese Buddhist tradition as well. So again, I wouldn't pin it down or make any kind of categorical statement that this is the Shurangama Samadhi, and because others might say, well, no. It's a misreading of it, or it should be translated this way rather than that way. So I'm not pretending to be an expert. But that dialogue did happen, and it was very, very, very fruitful. And it did seem to make perfect sense in the context of that that sutra teaching, as the community there understood it. So any questions, thoughts? Yes, you can use the microphone.
Regarding the passage that you just read, you read something about letting go of all of one's little habits, something in the last few sentences.
The mind becomes increasingly emptier and clearer, but it takes a lot of patience, endurance, and willingness to keep practicing under all conditions and to let go even of one's most treasured little habits. Mm.
So I was wondering if you could maybe expand a little bit what's meant by that, letting go of all of one's little habits, like all the little habits in the daily routine that one has, kind of investigating them and letting them go, or what he might refer to with little habits?
Again, you can add that to the list of questions for Lumpur Samhita when he comes out of quarantine. But I think it means both mental habits and physical habits. You know, that all of us have ways that we like to do things that we like to have, things we like to not have, our cherished opinions, things that ways that we call this important, we call that unimportant, we say this is beautiful, that's ugly, we value this particular expression of the teaching and we dismiss another as being not worthwhile. So I think the treasured little habits, you know, that I was talking with some other Sangha members this afternoon, how it's often the case we don't even realize what our habits are. We can have ways that we judge ourselves or judge other people. We don't even know that we're doing it. We can have ways that we like to do things. We don't even realize it's a way of doing things. It just seems completely normal. It's just like breathing, you know, that it's a so automatic. And so a lot of the practice is looking at the conditioning that we have as this human being and noticing those patterns of behavior, the things that we like, the things we dislike, what we approve of, what we disapprove of, how we like to arrange our room, how we like to wear our robes, how we like to, communicate with other people, the large array. I mean, not to try and make life more complicated or be looking for problems where there aren't any, but just to begin to notice the conditioning that's there. What makes us feel happy? What makes us feel distressed, you know? If we have something that we do that's approved of, how do we feel? You know, that I was giving that as an example earlier today, how I noticed that if I did something that was approved of or praised, I would have this sort of warm flush of, yes, it's a good thing, yes. It's an absolute good being praised or approved, was registering in my jitta as something as an absolute good value. And if I did something that was criticized or failed or was worthless, then I'd have this falling into a million pieces feeling. I'd be really distressed, really kind of broken into pieces feeling, totally disproportional to what had happened in the conversation. But it's like, so it took me a long time. I was a monk for 6 or 7, maybe 8 years before I really recognized that conditioning. That the habit of failure or disapproval or rejection is an absolute bad. That's absolutely bad and wrong and must be avoided at all costs. And being praised and approved and appreciated is an absolute good and must be acquired at all costs. it was kind of salutary. It was both embarrassing that it had taken me 7 or 8 years to notice that that happened, but then also simultaneously relieving. It's like, well, I'm really, really glad to see this is something that the jitta is so invested in, that this is such a strong habit. And that really, I thought, wow, I'm really, really dependent on being approved of and being appreciated and being liked. Like, wow, that's really a dependency. And so, so I started to look at that and to explore, you know, what's it like? What makes this good? And I could see that actually that the sort of grasping or that glowing feeling, that it was in a way it was quite restrictive, or there was a real sort of tightening, a clinging that was going on, that was investing in that, what they call a relishing, like there was, yes, that was real bhava tanha, there was a real grasping and identification with that. There's quite a lot of dukkha in a way involved in that. Similarly, if I was disapproved of or dismissed or not appreciated or had failed in some way, the kind of absolute badness of that, just to let myself feel that. What makes this so awful? What makes this so unbearable or so wrong? It's just, you know, you just cracked a joke that nobody laughed at. That's all. You know, big deal, really. But it was this broken into pieces feeling. And so I spent a couple of years just sort of looking at how the mind was invested in that, and then explore that. And then also, if I did things that or I acted in a way that wasn't seeking so much approval, if I felt I was being criticized, just not jumping in and trying to explain why actually, you know, I was really well-intentioned, but allowing people to misunderstand me or to be critical of me, and not to try and fix it or change it, but just to live with that. But let me explain. Just to take that, literally take that into the meditation and go to that feeling and say, you know, it's, you know, the mind is really inflating this feeling of being rejected or disapproved of. Look at that. And then realizing that in a similar way, just as grasping the approval was painful, grasping the disapproval was painful. And if you let go of the approval, it was just, okay, well, it's just, this is something is being liked. And then the disapproval, okay, this is something is being disliked. That's all. One is sweet, one is bitter. They're just flavors, that's all. It's like if you bite into a piece of birthday cake, it's a sweet taste. So, you know, if you bite into a curry with some bitter gourd in it, it's bitter. So, it's just a flavor. And that, so recognizing what our cherished habits, our treasured little habits are, recognizing what they are is one thing, but seriously, with that particular area, I'd say it took a couple of years of looking at it and exploring it till I could see that the mind wasn't really as addicted and dependent on those qualities as it had been. So, again, patience is a really important aspect of it. But just recognizing where the habits are, either how you like to set up your day, how you like to wear your robes, how you like to spend your time, it's one part of it. But the inner part, the treasured views and opinions, that's a little harder to track, but equally important. So it's not just physical habits or sort of the way you set your room up. It's the inner habits of attitude and judgment there. I would say it maybe is even more important. Does that make sense? Okay, to continue. One can believe that the sound of silence is something, quote unquote, or that it's an attainment. But it's not a matter of having attained anything, but of wisely reflecting on what you experience. The way to reflect is that anything that comes, goes. And the practice is one of knowing things as they are. No kind of identity is involved. There's nothing to attach to. Some people who hear that sound want to know, is that stream entry? Or do we have a soul? We're so attached to concepts. All we can know is that we want to know something. We want to have a label for our self, quote unquote. If there is a doubt about something, doubt arises, and then there's the desire for something. But the practice is one of letting go. We keep with what is, recognizing conditions as conditions and the unconditioned as the unconditioned. It's as simple as that. Even religious aspiration is seen as a condition. This doesn't mean that you shouldn't aspire, but just that you should recognize aspiration in itself as being limited. And emptiness is not self either. Attachment to the idea of emptiness is also attachment. Let go of that. The practice then becomes one of turning away from conditioned phenomena, not creating anything more around existing conditions. So whatever arises in your consciousness, anger, greed, or whatever, you recognize it is there, but you make nothing out of it. You can turn to the emptiness of the mind, to the sound of silence. This gives conditions like anger a way out to cessation. You let them go away. We have memories of what we've done in the past. They come up in consciousness when the conditions are there for them to come. That is the resultant karma of having done something in the past, having acted out of ignorance and done things out of greed, hatred and delusion and so forth. When that karma ripens in the present, the impulses of greed, hatred and delusion still come up in the mind, the resultant karma. Whenever we act on them ignorantly, when we aren't mindful, we create more karma. We can create karma in two ways, by following it or trying to get rid of it. When we stop doing this, the cycles of karma have an opportunity to cease. The resultant karma that has arisen has a way out, an escape hatch to cessation. So there's a few things there. As I said, sometimes teachers represent the inner listening, the hearing the sound of silence as some kind of attainment. It's a coincidence that the Pali word for stream is sota, and the Pali word for ear is sota. So when some people have come across this inner listening or this practice of listening, they say, the sound is entering the ear, or it's in the ear, so it's entered the sota. So maybe it's not stream entry, maybe it's ear entry. I've got it, Ajahn. I figured it out. It's just, this is what stream entry is. And so myself and Lumpur Pasano have a few times had to say no. It doesn't mean that. It's just like the word minute for 60 seconds and minute meaning very small. They're spelt the same, but they're totally different words. So sota, the ear, and sota, the stream, are different sotas, just in case anyone was wondering. Also, you have a term savaka sangha. Savaka means to listen or listening. So the community of the Buddha's disciples, and particularly the monastic disciples, are called the Savaka Sangha. So again, there have been those who developing this practice of listening to the nada sound, the sound of silence. So does this mean we're all the Savaka Sangha, with a Sangha of listeners? This is we're the ones who are listening. Maybe that's actually, people say you don't have this practice of listening to the nada sound in the Theravada scriptures, but actually, you know, Savaka Sangha, it's like the ones who are listening to the sound. That's right, Ajahn, right? No. It's at least as I understand it, the Savaka is listening to the sound of the Dhamma, listening to the words of the Dhamma teachings, those who listen to the teachings of the Buddha. As I understand it, maybe somebody who's here has a different take on it, or someone who's watching from around the country or around the world has a different take on things. But my understanding of Savaka is listening to the words of Dhamma, that is what constitutes the Sangha of the listening Sangha, is not listening to the nada sound, but listening to the words of the Dhamma teaching. So that I think that the point that Lumpur is making is that, you know, ideas can come up around it. Say, oh, so this is the music of the spheres. So wow, is this the sound of the cosmos? Is this, we're kind of tuning into the vibrations of the universe? And some spiritual traditions do read a lot into the sort of mystical significance of the sound and the different layers of vibration and so on. And I'm not poo-pooing that, but just as with the breath, you know, you can speak of the breath as a sort of the cycles of creation and destruction, the arising and passing of things. You can the rhythm of the breath can be seen as great symbolic and sort of mystical meaning. It can also just be taken as a biological function. It's like the body breathes because we depend upon aerobic respiration for our energy, and that's the way this particular brand of living being operates. We need to breathe. If we were devas, we wouldn't have to be breathing, but we're humans, so we need to breathe. So that it can be taken on a biological level. And so whenever Lumpo Sumato's taught this, and similarly when I've taught this as a practice, I tend to try and de-emphasize the grand symbolic imagery side of it, and say, well, whatever it comes from, whether it's the vibrations of the universe or whether it's just the buzzing in your ear of the little microscopic cilia, the little hairs that help your hearing process to work, or it's just the buzzing of the nervous system. It's present. whether it's of great cosmic significance or just a biological function or anything in between, we can hear it, mostly. We can feel it. And it can be used as a skillful tool, just like the breath. You know, you can see the breath as having great cosmic significance, you know, the cycles of the universe, or you can feel it, or you can recognize it just as the need to for the human body to respire and to stay alive, so that we breathe in, we breathe out. So we don't have to read a lot of that into it, but we can just use the presence of the breath or the presence of the inner sound. It's there, it's present, and it can be a skillful means that we can use. And so generally, adding less complication is beneficial. the more uncomplicated that we make our practice, the better. As the Buddha put it, apapanchang papancheti, don't complicate the uncomplicated. So don't make things more complicated than they need to be. And so that you know, the mind can read into things and say, what does this mean, or where's it coming from, or does this symbolize some kind of attainment? And it's helpful to just not follow that or elaborate a lot on that. As Lumpur was saying, you know, we want to have a label for ourself, quote unquote. If there's a doubt about something, doubt arises. So that we can use the presence of the inner sound to notice that doubt arising. What is this? Where does this come from? Arises, passes away. Is this the sound of the Dhamma itself? Is this the way the Dhamma appears in the material world? Question arises and passes away. Is this just the buzzing of my ears? Maybe I need to see the doctor. That arises and passes away. So when I was doing I think I mentioned the other day, I was doing a meditation class, a day-long workshop on listening to the nada sound in the States, and halfway through the afternoon, this fellow came up to me and said, I spent $20,000 going to medical appointments trying to get rid of this, and now you show me how to put it to work. So I think I want to go to my doctor and get my money back. And so, but he was kind of joking, but he was quite relieved that rather than thinking of it as a medical problem, he could actually put it to work and make it something that was of a immediate benefit in terms of spiritual support. So then with respect to the Lumpur's final comments about karma and and its results, so the word karma, Pali K-A-M-M-A, means action. And then resultant karma, the technical word for that is vipaka. So the phrase really should be karma vipaka, action and its result. So usually that's, in our ordinary everyday speech, that's shortened to karma, using the Sanskrit word, karma, meaning oftentimes that's taken as a kind of destiny or fate, but really essentially means is action and the result of that action. So it's not anything mysterious or strange, it's just here's the cause, here's the effect. So that when as he says, when karma ripens in the present, impulses of greed, hatred and delusion still come up in the mind, the resultant karma. Whenever we act on them ignorantly, when we aren't mindful, we create more karma. And so that's the normal way, either, as he says, suppressing things or following them. And so that we create, more complication, and we create more karma on top of that karma. One of the ways that the Buddha spoke about his teaching, and particularly the developing of the Eightfold Path, and I would say that this inner listening is very very much an embodiment of the practice of the path, is called the karma that leads to the end of karma, the action that leads to the end of action. And there's one of Ajahn Sucitto's very fine little Dhamma books is called Karma and the End, the Ending of Karma. And so that's a phrase that you come across. So when that when you see that, it's what its meaning is, the action that's taken that leads to the end of more more karma, more action that is formed out of delusion. So it's action that is taken based on Dhamma, action that is taken in accordance with the with reality, with Dhamma, and so that when the Eightfold Path is followed and developed in the most skillful way, then action is being taken. There's choices being made in terms of view, in terms of thinking, in terms of speech and action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and so forth. So effort is being made, direction is being given, action is being taken. But it's action that leads to the end of action, because it's not creating the causes for action that's going to be based on greed, hatred, or delusion, but rather it's the effect of following the Eightfold Path is peacefulness, is harmonious attitudes. In terms of we have memories of what we've done in the past, we come up in consciousness. One of the skillful means that I like to encourage when we, it's particularly meditation, and we're doing a lot of meditation, both in groups and in solitary meditation, the mind can easily go to things that we've done in the past, and particularly things that we regret. I don't know about your minds, but very, very rarely does my mind remember a completely average day when I was a university student or a school kid, or on a family holiday, that really ordinary day when nothing special happened. The mind doesn't go there. It goes to the exam that you cheated in, or the fight you had with somebody, or the clash you had with your dad, or it's like the hot points, and particularly places of regret and remorse are what the mind lands upon, at least in my mind. And so, particularly dealing with memories, or not just remorse for your own actions, can be resentment for being mistreated or hurt by others. A skillful means for letting the karma end is using a wise reflection that if this was somebody else's life, would it be so painful or so disastrous, or would you feel so bad about it that that children go to school and they fight with each other? That's not news. brothers and sisters, they argue with each other and treat each other badly from time to time. This is not news. This happens in every family. So just as a suggestion, and it's something that I do quite a bit, that I'll take a memory or a feeling of regret about something that's happened in the past in particular, but whatever the mind is latched onto, and to say, if this was part of somebody else's story, how would you feel? If you just heard that somebody had acted in that way, somebody had a fight with a school friend, or somebody had deceived someone they were, a friend at college, or someone had got into a temper living in a monastery and had an argument with another monk. Yeah. How would you feel if it was somebody else's story altogether? How would you feel about it? Just dropping that into the pool of consciousness. And then it's very interesting, because every single time the mind responds like, well, it's no big thing, or so what? well, that's not news, that's no big thing. Every time. And it's because it's my story, my memories, my ideas, you know, what I've done wrong or what someone has done that was painful for me, that's what gives the kind of sharpness and the way the mind creates keeps creating karma around it. If it's somebody else's story, the mind lets go of it very easily. So I find that a very helpful little thought experiment or exercise, reflective exercise, just to simply say, if this was somebody else's story, if this happened in somebody else's life, how would it feel? And just stop right there and then see what arises in the jitta. And it's a really revealing to me how it just, it's no big thing, it's nothing. Just so it just falls away. The mind then, when you look back and say, yeah, well, it wasn't somebody else, it was you, you know, it was me. But then it's changed the way the mind holds it. It doesn't take that sense of ownership, the I and me and mine doesn't gather around that in the same kind of way. At least that's how it takes shape in this mind. So I offer that as a suggestion to explore and to see how that might change the way that the mind relates to its memories and the way that we create our past and the world around us. So any final thoughts, questions? Okay, we'll leave it there for today.